You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan.
Welcome to this week's edition of the Soccer Report Extra podcast. I'm Bobby McMahon. And you are?
Owen O'Callaghan.
And we are going to talk, well, it's part of the show anyway this week, Champions League. We've now got through the first leg of the round of 16 completely. Sevilla and Manchester United today, nothing draw, and Shakhtar Donetsk 2-1 against Roma. But essentially, Owen, out of the eight games, three of them are, I guess, what they call in North America, dead rubbers. Which means something completely different in Britain and UK, of course. But
I thought you were being very mean to me there in your introduction. I was like, where's he going with this?
But three of them are dead, right? You got Bayern Munich 5-0 up, Manchester City 4-0 up, Liverpool 5-0 up. It's not going to happen. No chance in hell.
No, but at least we got some intriguing Champions League ties this week in terms of how everything played out, in terms of the quality that was provided to us, or lack thereof in certain cases. So shall we begin with Mr. Antonio Conte and his very, very, dare I say, surprising deviation from Chelsea's current blues, and I went there with the pun. So what did you make of this? Did this surprise you as much as it surprised me?
Not really. In as much as a couple of things. Barcelona's away form is, it's been off and on, but it's never been that great in terms of the Champions League. If they're getting a bad result, it's almost always going to be away from home. Not that this turned out to be a bad result necessarily. You get your one goal on the road. Conte getting a lot of praise, but I think during his Chelsea time, he seems to be much more comfortable in that kind of reactionary role and setting the team up to counter-attack and give up possession, a la Mourinho in many ways, than he was at the beginning of his, I wouldn't say career, because he was at Juventus, wasn't his first job, but remember on Soccer Report Extra podcast, when Conte took over Juventus, the drive that he had and the pressure that Juventus team put the opposition under was incredible. It was a very high tempo, but it didn't particularly work in Europe. And I think he's sort of, I wouldn't say necessarily gone over to the dark side, but his time with Italy, there's been a lot of comparisons with the result that Italy had against Spain in Euro 2016. And you've got a kind of situation where this is probably as good as he had a right to expect. I guess nothing or a win would have been even better. But going to Nou Camp, they've still got a chance, and I think they've got the ability to certainly cause Barcelona problems. And Barcelona have got their work cut out, because they've got some problems to solve, and one of them is a guy called Willian, who basically they never got a control of yesterday. And I don't know about you, Owen, but Busquets was a bit slow going out to challenge him, but that was a fantastic goal. Like, he lined that up perfectly. He knew exactly what he was doing at bending round Rudiger and the defender and right into the corner. It was just a cracking goal.
And he probably should have had another two before that as well.
Yeah, he's rattling the woodwork.
In terms of a player just totally being in the zone, it was very, very clear to him that once he got that shot away, the first one cracked off the post, I mean, sometimes players, get that sort of clear mind, clear focus sort of situation, and they think, right, I think I'm going to have one of those nights. And he was just, it was weird. I tweeted it during the game, before he scored actually, but just to say that, underappreciated is probably the wrong term to use for Willian, just because, he is a crucial player within a Premier League winning side, hugely rated by Jose Mourinho, And, you know, he will every so often, like a decent submarine, come to the surface and remind everyone just how terrific he is. But there is that sort of element to it where he's almost taken for granted a little bit, and maybe that's the greatest compliment that you can pay him. It was... I just thought there's a few things. I mean, you mentioned something that probably does need to be picked up on just a few moments ago, which was the Conte Juventus and that style of management that he kind of brought into that club that completely aligned with what Jurgen Klopp was doing at Borussia Dortmund and what Diego Simeone was doing at Atletico Madrid. And the exact same thing happened to all of those teams, that the approach got them to a certain level, essentially Champions League final, in the case of all three, but ultimately they were undone and they needed to box a little bit more clever. And I think with this sort of Chelsea performance under Conte, and also his comments afterwards about not wanting to play into the Barcelona hands, where you kind of have to pick your moments and you have to pick your battles against this team, otherwise they're absolutely going to destroy you. So, I mean, it is a little bit strange that you kind of, you know, witness a Conte team. I mentioned the irony, and you touched on it a second ago as well, the irony of a Conte performance of this calibre with this Chelsea team that was essentially straight out of the Jose Mourinho textbook. And for two people who really do not get on and don't particularly like each other, obviously the major blot on the copybook was the mistake that resulted in Messi's equaliser. But up to that point, it was a quintessential Jose Mourinho style performance in Chelsea.
Or a quintessential Roberto Di Matteo performance.
Mm. That too. You've just reminded me that Roberto Di Matteo was once Chelsea manager and won a Champions League with him.
And was in the Champions League manager in 2012.
Yeah.
Where is he now?
Oh, good Lord. Well, hang on a sec.
I'm not even sure.
He was at Aston Villa, wasn't he, for a cup of coffee?
Oh, I think it was... Yeah, and that went cold.
that instantly was thrown in the bin. Yeah. And I'm not sure what his next move was. I'm sure it was continental, was it? I mean, did he go somewhere?
Did he go to Russia or something?
I'm sure Luke will clear this up at the end of the program.
Yeah, we'll get that cleared away. But anyway, I thought it was very similar to that. You know, the memory of 2012. Of course, there's a second leg still to come, and Chelsea have got to go to the new camp and do it all over again. But the thing I think that Barcelona will be much more wary of, if they weren't wary before, was that shutting down that counter attack. Conte getting a little bit of criticism for some quarters for not starting Giroud, but quite honestly, against Barcelona, like I've always quite liked Giroud, and I'm, you know, but I've also, I think, been quite aware of his limitations. Mm. And playing a counter-attack game, Giroud just doesn't have that mobility that you're looking for there. And, you know, if somebody was going to get a start there, it would have been Morata, you would have thought. As it was, neither of them did, and they finished up with Hazard playing the false nine. And I wouldn't be surprised if the same thing happens again in a couple of weeks when they go to the new camp. They stick with the same plan, apart from coughing up and playing a square ball across your penalty area with 15 minutes left, which with Lionel Messi in opposition probably is not a good idea.
Yeah, I actually have to say that I was impressed with the way Chelsea set up. I had my doubts initially. I thought that maybe it was a game that could slip Hazard by a little bit in that role, and yeah, maybe he could be a little bit out-muscled and just physically kind of out-fought. But I thought it was actually quite surprising. I'm actually pretty convinced that it's not his most preferred position to be playing with his back to goal in like that for so much of a game, but I thought his touch was really, really sharp. I think it played to his strengths in terms of the intelligence he has as a player, and it also, I think, just at various times Chelsea did so well to get in behind them and really exploited how sometimes, you know, Barca can just get a little bit frazzled, and you know, it yeah. just it, you know, once that ball gets in behind them, it's kind of bodies getting kind of just a little bit more confused and discombobulated. And I think both Willian's efforts that came off the woodwork, I think, came from similar sort of moments like that where Chelsea just broke and got in behind them. But in saying that, I guess the massive concern is essentially the way they conceded that equaliser. I mean, you know, it's when you do go to Camp Nou, and it's can you maintain this level of discipline and this level of composure through an entire game?
Because they did really shut them down, didn't they? Like, there wasn't all that. Barcelona struggled to create some really good good chances, and they just. They looked like they were getting actually very frustrated, I thought, with the inability to turn the domination and play into actual good chances.
Yeah, there was always the moment where they just about hinted that they were going to do something, usually around the edge of the 18-yard box, but then there'd be a blue shirt, stick a leg out, break up the attack, maybe knock it out for a corner or out for a throw, and essentially you're just breaking that momentum. Suddenly you get more bodies back, and Barca have an even more difficult thing to try and break down. You know, there's momentarily some decent crosses coming in, you know, across the 6-yard area, but there was very, very little in terms of shots on goal, in terms of proper all-around moments that Courtois had to be pretty concerned with. And, you know, essentially what it kind of broke down to for me was a very Premier League error. You know, that ball that's just misplaced. You could probably get away with that 99% of the time playing in the Premier League, and that the opposing team just doesn't punish you as severely as it happens in Champions League. And you know, ultimately with Iniesta getting onto that pass, it was inevitable that he was going to be cute with what he was going to do next. You know, be it try and bend one inside that far post or tee up a teammate. And it actually, you know, as soon as Messi tapped it into the net, it was kind of one of those refreshing moments where you actually, two goals have been scored by the team, by the teams involved, and both of them were just taken really, really sharply by Willian at one end, and obviously Messi did something similar. It was, you know, you stick to the near post and just steer it. You know, it wasn't putting your foot through it and maybe opening your body up and sticking it to the far corner. Both players just stepped up and were a little bit more intelligent with their finishing. And obviously, you know, the great sort of narrative that we got force-fed to us beforehand about Messi and Chelsea and his tribulations facing this team and all the rest of that crap.
Well, it's incredible when you look at it. You look at the number of goals he scored against Arsenal. I think he's got 9 against Arsenal in Champions League. That was his first against Chelsea. So.
It's obviously every time that he has to, you know, look at a Chelsea lineup and see names of the quality of David Luiz, he obviously just shudders and thinks, oh no, tonight's not going to be my night. Not you again. Gary Cahill probably comes to him in his nightmares. You know, it's like, oh, Gary, no, I know you're much better than me. Stop it.
And then the good fairy Anders Christensen comes along and hands on a plate to him. Anyway, so we know that Chelsea are going to go to the Nou Camp, still very much alive in Champions League tie. That brings us into part one. We'll be back with part two in a couple of seconds.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra. Keep up to speed with the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen by liking us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Soccer Report Extra podcast, talking Champions League, and we've been through Chelsea-Barcelona. We're going to talk about Sevilla and Manchester United shortly, but... Owen, did you see the save with about 3 seconds left or 5 seconds left by Roma's keeper Alisson against Shakhtar Donetsk today?
I had read about this. Basically, the kind of narrative was step aside David De Gea and all of your wonderful sort of goalkeeping prowess that you displayed against Sevilla, and step forward Alisson, the Roma goalkeeper. So I have not seen it, so you need to shed some light on this.
it was kind of Shakhtar Donetsk were kind of killing off time. Ball finished up in the penalty area, and I think he made a save already, but he was certainly down, and ball broke to him. I'm not quite sure because I'm watching in Spanish, so I'm not quite sure actually who the ball broke to. It could have been Ferreira, who I think got the first goal, and he just sort of hit it, and Alisson was down on his back, and he just sort of leapt up, and or not even leapt up, but he just kind of stretched and just managed to parry it over. It was just a fantastic reaction save. But that here's before, once again, before we go back on Sevilla and Manchester United, but Ferreira, that scored the first goal for Shakhtar Donetsk. I thought I'd seen the name before. It's a guy who was with Newcastle. He was on loan at Newcastle and did dick all, as most players do when they go to Newcastle.
Is Dick Hall any relation to Freddie Hall?
Might be.
Just keeping that Newcastle relationship there.
But there he is playing for Shakhtar Donetsk in the round of 16. And that got, if that shot had gone in, then certainly Rome would still be in it. They'd be 3-1 down. But, you know, it would have made life a hell of a lot more difficult. And particularly difficult given that they actually went 1-0 up. But I was just thinking, I was just looking as well, just that this has absolutely nothing to do with the game at all. But on the back of Alisson's jersey actually has Becker, right? So his actual name is, I guess, is Alisson Becker. Is that the case?
Really? He's got Becker on the back of...
Yeah, and I was just sitting watching that, and I've thought, that's like the kind of name that appeared in a Nick Hornsby book. Right? You know, about some long-lost love he had when he was in high school or something. I remember, you know, when I was 16 and, you know, there was this girl, Alisson Becker. But he's not, he's a goalkeeper.
This is bringing the podcast in an absolutely remarkable direction. You've basically just written your first novel.
No, Nick Hornby got there first.
apparently, according to the internet tells me that Alisson, his full name is Alisson Ramses Becker. Becker, as in go. Boris Becker. Spelled the exact same way. Also, he's you know, he's got a girl's name. I'm going to let that slide, but maybe his parents were Elvis Costello fans. Who knows?
Well, maybe. I'm going to go back and check Nick Hornby's High Fidelity, one of my favourite books, because I'm sure that name's in there someplace.
Alisson Becker, yeah. I mean, it's definitely, it does sound like one of the top five, you know, best breakups or worst breakups that he's ever had in that book. Alisson Becker, if that character doesn't exist, it really does desperately need to exist now. So if any listeners out there are novelists or working on a screenplay, please, if you do name one of your central characters or any of your characters Alisson Becker, Bobby McMahon will come after you in court.
No, I'll waive the TM on that one.
Oh, okay. It might be a little, you just want a nice little reference in the foreword or something.
I just think there's 5 minutes we've completely wasted on talking nothing about soccer apart from a goalkeeper. Anyway, Sevilla and Manchester United. Now, okay, I'm going to flip a little bit to the other side here. Nothing. Manchester United not showing a lot of initiative and getting some criticism already, you know, checking the comments and checking generally the media response to it. But here's one for you. Have people not forgot Ferguson did this for years and away in the Champions League?
Yeah,
he'd go there and bore the pants off teams.
Yeah, but Ferguson was winning things while he was doing that.
But is this not the precursor to win the Champions League for Mourinho, the third team he'd do it with?
If it is, it'd be the. I mean, can you
no Manchester
final? Can you imagine Marcus Rocco as a Champions League winner? Goodness me!
But nothing, which, you know, on the face of it's regarded as a decent result. For both sides, the fact that Sevilla didn't concede the away goal. And Sevilla, I think, you know, they don't travel particularly well. They haven't travelled particularly well in Europe, even though they've had that run in Europa League. But they just looked to me like they just didn't actually have that, I wouldn't say wherewithal, but they didn't have that killer instinct in front of goal. They just played like a team which, okay, we missed that one. Oh, I guess we'll go out and try again. But they just didn't seem to bear down. Having said that, they're also a team, I think that have got lots of pace on the counter-attack, and I can't really see Mourinho coming out and playing a very expansive game in the next game either.
No. I think that based on history, you'd almost say this is kind of a classic Champions League first leg where, you know, the higher profile elite team gets a little bit of a scare and then the game goes back to their own backyard and they kind of put everything to bed. But that's the thing about this United side under Mourinho in terms of how they play. You can't really be sure of that. You can't really be too confident that that's the pattern that the second leg is going to develop as. And I think that that's a reflection as to the biggest concern and the biggest issue that Mourinho has. The way that he is doing things at the club, it just means that you can't really be too confident going into any fixture that you face. I mean, tonight, I think Nick Harrissey does great work with Sporting Intelligence. Had a couple of great graphics over the last day or two. So we're recording this on a Wednesday. So over the two nights of Champions League, where he essentially has in graph form, like a bar chart form, the gulf between the teams currently competing at this level of the Champions League and Manchester United against Sevilla. It's just, I mean, the gulf is just so wide between the two of them. Now, the other Champions League results have followed exactly to plan. As of right now, the elite high-profile team are in control. Some, obviously, of the teams are in more control than others. But Manchester United really are the exception. This game tonight, it really should not have been this difficult. Yes, you can always argue the toss that it's knockout European football and there's no easy game and kind of all those other cliches. But when you start a game by, you know, having Paul Pogba on a bench and trying to make some sort of statement with it, it's just, you know, we talked about Chelsea recently and stuff just not sitting right in terms of the club. And United at the moment, you go through over the last number of results, it's just been, you know, it's like they're, you know, up to their knees in treacle and they're just trying to, you know, take a couple of steps. It's just so laborious. And I think somebody made a good point in the immediate aftermath of this first leg that was played today, that ultimately whatever happens in the second leg, one of these two teams is the team that everyone else wants in the competition at the next stage. You know, I think that that was a pretty damning way of putting it. And, you know, the fact that they didn't really have a decent chance, did they? I mean, there was a Lukaku volley.
Well, there was the Lukaku, but that was pretty obvious, a handball.
Yeah.
I don't think anybody would disagree with that. And the thing, you know, going back to my point about the chances that Sevilla kind of wasted, that game, watching it, you know, with 20 minutes left, 15 minutes left, even at 0-0, if somebody had told me that this game was going to finish up 2-0 Sevilla, I wouldn't have been all that surprised. It was one of these games that you could, you know, based on the play and all the rest, it wouldn't have been, that wouldn't have been out of sorts in terms of reflecting the chances created and the effort put in by Sevilla on it, because they had good width. They seem to, you know, they played nice up until that 18-yard box, and then once the ball got in the box, it just lasted. They just didn't have that cutting edge that, and they might well pay for it in the end when they go back to Old Trafford. Because I think if Manchester United go in front, I think Sevilla will have a very hard time kind of clawing that back. Because I think you'll see Mourinho resorting to, you know, holding on to what they've got. But as I say, I wouldn't have been surprised in this game if it had finished up 2-0 Sevilla and United would have had this massive, because I think if, you know, if they'd gone a goal down, I just don't think United were in their head, I don't think their head was in the right place to actually come back from that. And that's where I could have, you know, seen another one going in if it happened.
It did. I mean, it was weird watching this today, because there was an element of wider kind of goldfish memory a little bit. How long has Alexis Sanchez been at United for now?
When did that deal go through? That was about the week before. That was the last week of the transfer deadline.
So let's say he's been there about three and a half weeks or something, 4 weeks.
We're talking about, you know, at least 3 weeks, probably, right. Probably a little bit over 3 weeks.
I mean, was he even on the pitch today?
Well, he was, because he got dispossessed a few times.
I mean, the thing is that, you know, when this signing was made and you know, you got excited by the possibilities of an exciting attacker, and you think particularly of away games where, you know, you may decide to play, not necessarily in the counter, but certainly pick and choose your moments of when you want to attack an opposition. You look at a player like Sanchez who could be crucial and key to Manchester United in those sorts of situations. And then you watch that today. You wouldn't even have known that Alexis Sanchez was on the park. So you've got You've got Paul Pogba sitting on the bench. You've got an exuberant, energetic attacker selected. And you draw 0-0 by not threatening anything offensively. It's just a weird thing. And you know, this was supposed to be the big second season, you know, where United make a statement. And you know what? You made an interesting point before we started kind of getting into the meat of this discussion, which was, you know, is he making a big play for a Champions League? And you know, would it be deeply surprising if Jose Mourinho gets to the latter stage of a Champions League? Not really. You could never write this guy off. But there was an element watching it today, and obviously following the reaction to it. Something came back to me. It's probably a weird reference, but you remember the World Cup in 1994, and the fact that Italy got to the final against Brazil, and the Italians were managed by Arrigo Sacchi at the time, who you know, was a revolutionary figure and was a remarkable coaching figure with that AC Milan team in the late 80s, and everyone hated that Italian team. They were just so boring. They almost got to that final, essentially owing to the genius of Roberto Baggio. And Sacchi hated Roberto Baggio and subbed him off earlier in that tournament, almost sabotaged him. And the thing was, it struck me today because I was watching it. I was thinking that coaches, it's just that fine sort of line, isn't it, where you have a peak. And it's not like a player whereby you can kind of, you know, on the field, you can have a peak in terms of, you know, if you're a goal scorer, you have seasons where you hit 27, 26 goals. You probably won't ever not be scoring goals. You're just probably not scoring goals at the same rate. With coaches, it's very, very different, where if you're an iconic coach, if you're a revolutionary coach, you're winning on a range, it's fine. But it's a very, very quick plateau. Whereby, you know, it's a very, very quick jump to you not really doing much at all. When other coaches figure you out, when other teams can combat you and play against you to a much greater extent. And I was watching Mourinho today and I'm like, Mourinho is now at that stage where people don't fear the ridicule for calling him out and for saying, this is the absolute most boring heap of shit that I've ever watched in my life and I'm sick of it. And you know, particularly for that first season, it was United in transition. Mourinho has gone in there and he has to kind of put his own stamp on things. Now, not everybody, there's still a lot of people who are behind him and all that sort of stuff. But are we getting to a situation now where, you know, it's a kind of a little bit of a broken record? I understand, obviously, league position is still there. It's pretty, pretty solid. But, I mean, if United do meekly bow out at the Champions League at a quarterfinal stage, where do we stand in terms of the Mourinho United thing, even though he's signed a new lucrative contract?
Well, it's then they give him more money to spend on more players, right?
Well, is that it? They've just kind of totally been immersed now in the Mourinho thing, and that's going to be it.
Like, you know, what do they do? Yeah, what do they do? They give him, well, it wouldn't be the first team to give him a new contract and then let a manager go. But, you know, I think they're heading down that very obvious path of here's some more money, but you know, I think it's something he's been accused of, and Manchester United have been accused of, and I think it's quite valid. It's what's the pattern? Like, what's the philosophy? What is he trying to build? Like he has this sort of puzzle, a bunch of puzzle pieces, but the puzzle pieces don't fit together, and many of the puzzle pieces he's been given are the kind of puzzle pieces you really should be, if you're serious, you should be thinking about building a team. If you're paying Sanchez the money that they are paying Sanchez, and the money they spent to get Paul Pogba back, would it not be natural to start building the team around these two players? And a few others, you got Matic, obviously, you got De Gea in the goal. But none of the kind of supporting cast seem to really be there for any other reason than we've got some money, go out there and spend some money on players. Like it started under, you know, they never gave the money to David Moyes, But certainly, once a panic set in, it happened under Louis van Gaal, and I kind of think van Gaal kind of started it, and Mourinho kind of continued it. But I really can't see what he's really trying to achieve. Maybe you go back to the Chelsea years. Mourinho got a lot of praise, and deservedly so in many ways, for that Chelsea team that he developed or he picked up in 2004-2005. But a lot of these players were never signed by Mourinho.
Mm.
A lot of these players were signed by Ranieri or were on their way soon after Ranieri left, and really before Mourinho had a say in whether they're going to. Yes, he signed the Portuguese crew, and that was important. But a lot of these players were in place before. He had a very, very solid base to work from, and now I can't see any pattern to what he's doing here to try and turn Manchester United into a cohesive, attractive unit. And of course, to cap this all off, you've got, even though we're going to talk about Guardiola, his moments on the weekend or on Monday in a few minutes. The reality is that just like he was showing up in Spain up against Guardiola, he's been showing up in England against Guardiola, because that then becomes a measuring stick. Yes, Guardiola's had a team that's gone out and spent lots of money, but there seems to be a plan there, and they seem to be buying players, or they seem to have bought players that fit that plan. I'm not sure what the Manchester United plan is.
And the other thing as well that I kind of found funny in terms of the contract, Mourinho, at the end of the season, Mourinho will be entering his third year as Manchester United manager. And when has this guy ever been a 3+ year manager at a club in a situation that's ended well? Which it's just another thing that was kind of in the back of my mind, where you're wondering, does anybody have a strategy in place? It be that a managerial strategy, be that a personnel strategy, is everyone just essentially shutting their eyes and going, we are so rich, and that's the kind of conversation? Because is there anyone ultimately in that room again saying, to be honest, guys, I thought that Mourinho was a little bit of a short-term hire for us to get us to a certain level, and then because of his past history, we may have to be a little bit smart, because we don't want to be hanging around, paying this guy off, 10.5 million a year like Chelsea were doing because of that too much compensation they had to fork out. Instead, it just means that for United, ultimately, none of this matters. And like what you said, the conversation in that boardroom and between the top brass is, you want how much, Jose? Yeah, here you go. No worries, bud. Yeah. Happy days.
Okay, so unfortunately, it's not the same with us, because there's nobody sitting there giving us millions and millions to spend. That brings us to the end of part two. We'll be back with part three, talking about the Carabao Cup final in just a couple of seconds.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra with Bobby McMahon and Owen O'Callaghan. Be sure to follow them both on Twitter. Links are in the show notes below. Now back to the show.
We're going to look forward to this Sunday's Carabao Cup final, Manchester City and Arsenal. First trophy, because we're not going to count the Community Shield, first trophy of the season to be decided. And Manchester City, if we're talking last week at this time, they'd just come off 4-0 away win Champions League against Basel. You'd be talking in terms of, well, this is Manchester City's chance to actually pick up their first trophy of the season. They've still got the quadruple on, but they don't anymore, and it's Wigan that did it to them again. Third time they've knocked them out of the FA Cup. This has got to be the biggest shock of them all, though, isn't it? The FA Cup final was a big one, obviously, the fact that Cup was at stake, but this is Wigan a la League One, and they've done it to City again.
Well, because Will Griggs on fire, and their defence was terrified. That's apparently.
But isn't that just the usual excuse, though?
Well,
isn't it?
Well, I mean, listen. Let's not. You know, be mean to all of those people who just sing that chant relentlessly and tweet it mercilessly and bring it up at every possible opportunity that they get. We do appreciate that when Will Grigg scores, he is on fire. We don't need to be continuously reminded of it. Anyway, rant over. But yes, the most joyful thing about this Manchester City defeat was the fact that Pep Guardiola was not undone by a celebrated, astute, well-decorated, you know, coaching guru based in continental Europe. He was undone, in fact, by a rotund, angry scouse in Paul Cook. You know, memorably and formerly of Sligo Rovers in the League of Ireland. So I think that made it extra special when you kind of the circumstances of the defeat for Manchester City is it kind of so inexplicable. It just kind of adds to the surrealness of the entire sort of episode. A bit like, you know, an episode of Curb Your Enthusiasm or something, where stuff happens that is quite bizarre, but you just kind of continue with it. Exactly.
You don't see it
obviously,
coming.
Obviously, question marks surrounding Mr. Guardiola's behaviour. He did share a tête-à-tête with Mr. Cook and quite a few others, including Peter Reid, who apparently is a club consultant or something for Wigan. I don't really know what that means. They had their little... tunnel bus stop, nothing like Roy Keane, Patrick Vieira, Man United, Arsenal type tunnel bus stop, but still it was quite entertaining, I guess. Ultimately what happened is Man City lost. You have to wonder, will it affect them in any substantial way? You would have to think that in the grand scheme of things, the vast majority of Manchester City players won't even remember this game. And they probably won't even reflect too much on what it means. And
oh, they'll remember that one.
You think so?
Oh yeah, they might not want to remember it. They'll remember it. God,
I'm not sure how much they maybe remember was the wrong term to use. Perhaps dwell on it is probably the more accurate.
No, you've obviously got, if you dwell on it, you're thinking in the past and you're not focusing on what you've got to do in the future. I would agree with you there, but they'll remember it.
You think it's one of those things
like
that...
You tell me Aguero's not going to remember it?
Well, yeah, but I mean, that's kind of aftermath stuff, isn't it, really, with, you know, with the unsavoury shit. But, like, in terms of the result and being beaten and, you know, getting... experiencing a bit of an embarrassing result, do you think that's going to stay with the likes of... you know, Bernardo Silva and, you know, the other guys of that ilk?
Oh, it's going to get an excerpt in their books, you know, the low of that season. Here's a question for you. Is Kyle Walker going to do that little dance he did again? The Kyle Walker little dance he did on the goal.
What was he
trying to do there?
I've no answer to that question. It's absolutely insane. I'm not quite sure. But it's weird. When the goal took place... I actually was convinced in my stupidity, I was convinced that there was no way that Man City could have been that vulnerable. I was waiting for someone else to sweep around the back. I just didn't think that Grigg was just going to be left with just one immediate pass and then for City to be absolutely cut to ribbons. I also, you know, in my stupidity, thought that Grigg was going to absolutely shank it wide. But credit to him, he took it on and absolutely nailed it to the far corner. Again, you kind of convince yourselves, it's going to be a big chance, but ultimately quality is going to come through and he's going to put it wide and City will live again. Whereas sometimes they don't get out of jail free, and I think that this was one of those moments. And for it again, like as you referenced, for it to be Wigan again, it's just absolutely insane. They've caught them out so frequently.
Yeah. Any qualms about the Delph red card? I thought it was a dead cert. I don't see how you could complain about that.
You know what? In the moment, Which is probably not always the best way of judging it, because, you know, occasionally your eyes will deceive you. But in the moment, I did do the grimace, and I did do the audible kind of the audible gasp. Yeah, the kind of the kind of, oh no, the there's going to be a pending situation here. So I did think that, yeah, you bring it back to the, is he in control of what he's doing? And I'm not really sure if Delph was. I think he was high, and it definitely ventured into reckless territory. I think obviously the confusion is the initial yellow card. You know, was it going to be a yellow that was going to be shown to him, and then suddenly there was a bit of I don't know what you would call it, maybe influence or otherwise. The Roy Keane Manchester United versus Middlesbrough classic moment, when the entire Man United team gathered around a referee. So something along those lines, potentially. But it certainly irked something with Guardiola on the sideline, who absolutely went off on one, which he is partial to do every once in a while, have a little bit of a blow up. Another kind of another very romantic sort of story, isn't it? You kind of, there's that, those moments where you just kind of love as well that, you know, there's that tunnel dust up, and this guy's like Peter Reid and Paul Cook that are immersed in it with Guardiola. It's just, there's just so far removed from you know, the Cruyff school of Catalan brilliance and Barcelona education. And yeah, sometimes in a game of football, they'll go and do you. And your history and culture matters absolutely fuck all.
Sort of the wounded animal scenario going into Sunday against an Arsenal team that's not quite sure what we're going to see on Sunday from Arsenal. And we know that Ospina's going to be in the goal. We know that Mkhitaryan is cup-tied. I guess Aubameyang has got to be in this starting lineup. The fact that Lacazette's out as well, Ozil's ill, Ramsey's a fitness problem. It's not looking too good for Arsenal, is it?
It's definitely not ideal, but Arsenal have those kind of weird moments when, regardless of...
Well, let's face it, they're no Wigan though, are they?
Hey, listen, you know, we know that Man City like it up them, you know, so whether or not Arsenal can do that is another thing. Sometimes, yeah, Arsenal are one of those teams where they maybe have some personnel issues, and you kind of, they head into a game and it's an easy point to make that, oh, you know, they're without a couple of high caliber players, but then it doesn't really matter for whatever reason. They have, again, Arsenal are a little bit of an inexplicable kind of side. It's like you said, you don't genuinely know what type of Arsenal are going to turn up. Now, the thing is, obviously in recent years, domestic cups, you know, have been pretty kind to them. They can kind of, you know, maybe it says something about Wenger's ability to motivate in big one-off games. Obviously, the counter-argument to that, I'm sure people are yelling it at their iPhones or iPods or radios at the moment, is Arsenal in European competition, which are other high-profile games.
Never won the League Cup either, right?
Which is a pretty weird one, isn't it? It's kind of a weird fact about a team that, you know, have picked up quite a substantial amount of silverware. So it's an odd one. I don't know how much I would count the individual stuff in terms of a potential roadblock for Arsenal. I think that it is a curious sort of cup final. You know, League Cup, like last year, League Cup served us up a pretty nice one. 5 goals, plenty of entertainment.
So
and it's always patchy when you're dealing with a cup final. You're never quite sure how it's going to go. It's a curious one. It's you know, ultimately, again, I'm not sure. You were pretty adamant that the defeat to Wigan would affect Man City, even if this game against Arsenal doesn't go their way. Do you think that's something else that they will remember? You know,
no, I think it's. I would say Guardiola is probably going to, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if he finished up using that defeat to Wigan as a, you know, the fact that the us against them, the circle the wagons kind of philosophy. Talking to the players about, look, they're all laughing at us out there because we lost to Wigan. Now there's the time to go out and win the first trophy of the season, and you know, and you can celebrate, and Wigan will be, as far as the media is concerned, instantly forgotten. still would contend that the players will bear a bit of a scar for that, and it might turn out to be a very small scar in a season that could bring a lot more for Manchester City. Yeah, the fact that they've basically walked away with the league. They're going to continue to walk away with the league. So it really comes down to winning this game on Sunday and continue to go deep into Champions League, which I really think they fancy their chance of winning this time. So yeah, it could very much be a footnote, but at some point these players will always remember that wet Monday night. Was it a wet Monday night or was it just a Monday night?
I think in the annals of English football, it will forever be a wet Monday. I think that we can safely say that, because there are just so many of them.
Yeah.
So yeah, it just fits into the cultural and historical context there, I think.
So we'll be back next week and we'll talk about whether Manchester City have actually do go ahead and win the first trophy of the season, or whether Arsenal upset the bookies and upset the odds and give Arsene Wenger a trophy that he's never won before. We will know come Sunday. So that brings the end of part 3. We'll be back with part 4 when we'll bring producer Luke back and we'll do some fact checking.
You're listening to Soccer Report Extra. Keep up to speed with the podcast and get all the latest news, musings and rants from Bobby and Owen by liking us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Now back to the show.
What have you come up with this week, Luke?
You mentioned that the Chelsea performance reminded you of an old Roberto Di Matteo performance.
Yes.
So he started his career MK Dons 2008-2009, West Brom 2009-2011, Chelsea in 2012, then Schalke. He didn't go to Russia, but he went to Germany. And he coached Schalke 2014-15, and then Aston Villa 2016. He was with them for their FA Cup win, 2-1 over Liverpool, and their first UEFA Champions League title in 2012 with the penalty kick shootout win over Bayern Munich after a 1-1 draw. But he was dismissed later that year. The performance that maybe is jogging your memory, Bobby, is in round of 16, second leg, a 4-1 win over Napoli to overturn a 3-1 loss in the first leg from the Villas-Boas regime.
So
then they won 5-4 on aggregate to then move on and then ended up winning the... So that was kind of a turning point there, I think.
Yeah, so it was a tournament of penalties. Messi missing, then Rob... Was it Arjen Robben, Owen, that missed the one in the... Champions League final?
Yeah, Robin missed one, and then Drogba stepped up to score the winner, and then all I remember is being in the flash zone after that game, and with every other Bayern Munich player refusing, really, except for Manuel Neuer, to speak to the press, understandably, obviously, because they just lost in front of their own fans in their own city. The other Bayern Munich player who was speaking openly to the press, Arjen Robben, which always struck me as him being very much... a guy who enjoys being the centre of attention, or also somebody who doesn't really have any issue fronting up when he's screwed up. But that's always stuck with me, the fact that when he was part of that narrative, he was facing his former club and all that sort of stuff, and he had a bit of a mistake, but he was still talking to the media afterwards. I was like, that's pretty interesting.
So we were also talking about Facundo Ferreira.
Yes.
Who was an Argentine U20 international. He had 12 appearances and 5 goals for the U20s for his home country. Played for Shakhtar since 2013, has 62 appearances, 35 goals, and spent 2014-15 on loan at Newcastle, where he made 0 appearances and scored 0 goals. So he did indeed complete Dick Hall.
Hey.
Speaking of Dick Hall, Dick Hall was born July 3rd, 1945, in Weymouth, Dorset, England, but ended up immigrating to the U.S. and spent 1970 to 76 playing for the Dallas Tornadoes of the NASL, and made four international appearances for the U.S. men's national team between 73 and 75. So Dick Hall... U.S. Retired U.S. international, age 72.
There you go.
And then you were wondering if Alison Becker appeared in that Nick Hornby book, High Fidelity. Yeah. It wasn't Alison Becker. It was Alison Ashworth.
Oh, close,
Rob, was Rob Fleming's first girlfriend who dumped him after 3 days.
But in the next book, he can just pronounce, he can just spell Alison the way the goalkeeper spells it with two L's, and it's a completely different character.
Those are all my notes.
Okay, well, thanks very much, guys, and thanks very much for listening, and we will be back, and hopefully you will join us next week. For someone who's so keen to snuggle, you
cause a lot of trouble. Thanks for listening to Soccer Report Extra. To keep tabs on the podcast and get all the latest news, musings, and rants from Bobby and Owen, like us on Facebook at Soccer Report Extra. Music for this podcast graciously provided by Manitoba's hottest indie pop group, Misery Slims. Check them out on Spotify and YouTube, and follow the band on Facebook at Misery Slims.